This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the problems facing Boeing after failures of its Starliner spacecraft have left two astronauts stranded in space. They were supposed to be on the International Space Station for 8 days, but will now be there for at least 8 months. This is the latest in a long line of crises facing the company. So is this one failure too far for Boeing? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello everyone, we have a story with the police today and tension within the PSNI between gay and straight officers. Why does sexuality come into it, you might ask? We're asking that question too. You'll hear the story being explained on the programme today. A weight loss drug that some people are describing as the fountain of youth as well, stops you ageing. Is that too good to be true? You'll find out in this podcast. And banning our Education Minister, Paul Given, giving out advice as to when phones should be banned in schools or restricted use in schools. I'm asking the question, if we do that to young people, what about the adults? What about the politicians in Stormont? All coming up this morning on The Nolan Show from the BBC. This chair, I keep on putting it up. It couldn't be the weight of me. And I sit on it and it just sinks down after about 10 minutes. Hope you enjoy today's programme.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. Last week, the Nolan Show broke the story of how a LGBT network within the PSNI were excluding straight members of its group from training it was providing to help its members get promoted. They insisted in a memo they sent around the PSNI that people had to identify, not members of their group, as members of their group, they had to identify as gay to get that training. Well, the story moves on this morning as the Nolan Show has now secured information. We now have seen a letter which has been sent by a straight member of the PSNI fighting back within the force and saying that sexuality should be no part of this. And it is not clear whether this person remains a member of the LGBT network or indeed is still in it. But we know he's straight and we know that this person is fighting back. He writes as follows, and this sent within the PSNI. You have outlined these sessions as support created by the LGBT network in response to a request by LGBT network members. Yet your initial email offered it out service-wide with the caveat that only those who identify as LGBT are eligible, whether network members or not. I feel it is therefore not based on network membership, as you claim, but sexuality alone. I should point out that a number of years ago, I signed up as an ally of the network, a decision I made entirely in the spirit of inclusivity. So this guy's saying, I joined this LGBT network not because I was gay, but because I wanted to support my gay colleagues. I wanted to be inclusive. And now this person finds himself excluded from training unless he puts his hand up and suddenly says, I'm gay. When an internal organisation, he says, seeds division, intentionally or not, we should remember the one organisation that brought us all together to begin with, the PSNI. Religion, sexuality or politics should not matter in the organisation, let alone a promotion process. Anyone holding posts should be there based on merit, not because a particular sexuality feels underrepresented. And the PSNI, they issued a number of emails on Friday morning, And they've said that they have addressed their concerns regarding these emails directly with the network, but they say they would encourage. Now, the key word in this PSNI statement is that it does not say require. They have said they encourage all leaders within the PSNI to ensure that all officers and staff who would help and support ongoing development, including exams and promotions, are able to avail of it. So the PSNI are not requiring this, that sexuality is not an issue, is not a determinant. They are encouraging it. TUV leader Jim Allister has written to the Chief Constable about all of this. Tell us why, Jim. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I think the fundamental to any promotion process is that all applicants should be on an equal footing. And if within the PSNI you have people being specially tutored on the basis of their sexuality to give them an advantage, then I think that does corrupt the equality of the process and creates a very serious situation. We really are almost at a force within a force, where under the aegis of the PSNI itself, the LGBT community are using the facilities of the police, using the web system of the police to promote advantage on the basis of sexuality. Well, that totally flies in the face of any promotion process being merit-based and everyone on an equal footing. So I think it's a pretty fundamental assault on the equality issues that should prevail within the PSNI.
What have you said to the Chief Constable? What have you asked for?
I've asked for clarification as to whether PSNI premises are being used for this tutoring, whether it's been done in police time, because I want to know exactly how implicated the PSNI corporately is on this. The fact that their web system has been used suggests to me they are corporately implicated, and I do think the Chief Constable needs to sit back and ask himself the question, how can this promotion competition be fair if it has been assaulted in this way by tutoring for one section, bizarrely on the basis of their sexuality, something that's not available to all who might apply for promotion.
Well, this LGBT network within the PSNI that is providing this training for some of its members. So they're excluding their members who aren't gay. Emphasise again, the LGBT network does not just consist of gay people. There are gay allies, yes. For example. There are allies, for example, who are straight, who think to themselves, I want to be part of that group to help our LGBT colleagues. They are excluded from the extra support.
No, the tutoring is only for those who profess themselves to be gay. No one else. So that is where the assault on the merit principle comes in, and where it defeats the equal footing approach on any promotion competition.
Now, to be fair, it's my understanding that this LGBT network, they don't have, you know, any special access to exam questions. They don't have any of that. They're simply putting on within their network extra training for some of their members. But will the PSNI senior management team, are they tolerating any situation where straight people are excluded anywhere in the PSNI simply because they're straight? It's a question for the management team of the PSNI, and it seems to be within the emails that the statements that the PSNI have issued that they're not insisting on equality on the basis we're speaking about. They're encouraging it.
Yeah, and I think there is a point here, and it would be interesting to see what the Equality Commission think of this, because they have lectured us all many times about the need for equality in job situations, and if you're going for promotion, you are competing with compatriots. If some of those compatriots have had special tutoring that you haven't had and you've been denied it because of your sexuality, then surely that is a fundamental equality issue.
The diktat, the requirement from this LGBT network, they say you do not have to be a member of the LGBT network to avail of these revision classes, but you must identify as LGBT+. Now, what I'm interested in is why. why must you identify? These are officers who are also on the ground, who are dealing with gay and straight people on the ground in society. Why is sexuality so important to them? It's not that they're just providing this training. If they were just providing this training to their members, you can see an unquestionable logic to that. They're actually excluding some of their members based on their members' sexuality.
They're consciously basing it on sexuality, and that surely is a fundamental equality issue, which I think corrupts the promotion process, because if you have people who are have advantaged over others who aren't on an equal footing because of the tutoring under the, it would almost seem, the official aegis or through the offices of the PSNI, then surely those who weren't afforded that have been disadvantaged. And does that not call into question the equity and fairness of the very promotion process?
How would you encourage then, how would you help members of the LGBT community in our society to rise up the ranks of the police and indeed any other organisation in Northern Ireland?
I don't think anyone on the basis of their sexuality should be prioritised within any organisation. I think if it is a promotion competition, then it's open to all, no questions asked about your sexuality, but you all compete on an equal footing. Once you corrupt the equal footing basis, then you've corrupted the process. And that is the fundamental objection here.
Well, we're getting in contact right now with the Equality Commission to ask them if they're interested in this practice within the police. Michael St. Norwich, our first call of the day. Morning, Michael.
Good morning, Stephen. It's just a quick observation there. I mean, among that LGBTQ community, growing up, they must have suffered some either horrific or some sort of terrible discrimination. And for those people to now want to visit that on innocent people, I can't understand that. Discrimination is discrimination.
What do you mean?
By the very fact that they're only tutoring the ones who identify as part of that community. That is discriminating against the other members of society. And I'll tell you what's even worse, Stephen. At least the ones who discriminated against them come from a place of ignorance. The members of that community know exactly what it's like to feel that discrimination, yet they still want to visit it on other people. I don't understand that.
So what would you... The PSNI senior management team, they are standing by their statement which they issued on Friday night, which does not tell these people, does not require them to stop doing it. The PSNI are encouraging their officers, their leaders across the PSNI, as they put it, to ensure that all officers and staff who want support, including preparation for exams and promotions, are able to avail of it. But it's not a requirement, Michael. The key word is encouraged. PSNI senior management team are allowing it to happen.
That's dancing on the head of a pin. It should, promotion should be solely on meritocracy. If you don't deserve it, you don't get it. And if you do deserve it, you do get it.
Well,
that's the way of the world.
Remember, that is what will happen within the board process. This is an LGBT network providing extra classes. This is not the actual board.
So they're getting a foot up against someone who's not part of that community, and you're trying to say that that's not discrimination. When they're getting extra tutoring, if you claim to be part of that community, you get extra tutoring. That's discrimination, Stephen. Well, whatever way you want to dress it up, it's discrimination.
Jamal, so the other question that I'm asking this morning is, if this is the mentality of the officers within that LGBT network, how do they then treat straight people on the ground when they're policing?
Well, they obviously think that straight people are to be treated with lesser privilege when it comes to competing in promotion, because they're not interested in assisting them in the competition for promotion. If that's a mentality that reflects through in policing, then it is even more concerning. But to me, the biggest concern here is the attitude of the senior management team. they, by endorsing this approach, have flawed the process. This is their process, their promotion process.
Well, they're not endorsing it, are they? They're encouraging these.
They're not doing anything to discourage it. Let's be clear.
They say they've addressed their concerns directly with the network.
Yes, and what were those concerns, and how did they address them, and how come the outcome is that the network continue doing what they're doing? And doing what they're doing is defeating the equal footing principle of any promotion process. And the senior management team seem to have bought into that, and that's very concerning.
Well, how have they bought into it if they're encouraging leaders to ensure all officers can avail of the support, Jim?
But they're not requiring it.
Correct.
They're allowing it to continue as is. So they're encouraging this mentality of a force within a force and aiding the promotion of those on a certain basis of sexuality. That surely is not something a senior management team should be endorsing or facilitating. It's something they should be seeking to stamp out.
Well, John Burroughs, former senior police officer. Jim Alistair, thank you very much. John,
the
one of the fundamental pillars that the police are trying to ensure the message is driven throughout Northern Ireland is impartial policing. That should be within their own force, and the practices within their own force as well is essentially what Jim Alistair is saying.
Yeah, morning, Stephen. Look, it's hard to disagree on that point. You know, I think this goes to the values of the organisation. And I think that's, leaving aside the legal, you know, parts of it, you know, this goes to the values of the organisation that should be promoting, you know, impartiality, inclusivity, and not excluding people, not being discriminatory. And I think the LGBT network should be promoting those values too, and role modelling that. And I think this is a mistake. And I have to say to you, it's quite unedifying now that this is playing out, you know, publicly. It's playing out clearly across the organisation with these emails that are circulating. And I think someone in senior leadership needs to put their foot in the ball, stop it, reflect, and get a clear message out about how these things should be done.
Well, they have put a message out, haven't they? They've issued a public statement encouraging. Why do you think they're not requiring the LGBT network to allow access to any officer, no matter what their sexuality is? Why do you think they're not doing that?
Well, you know, when I say put the foot in the ball, I mean put the foot in the ball properly. And I don't know. I don't know whether they're a little bit maybe cautious of not being seen to be supportive of the LGBT network. Because, of course, look, in Northern Ireland, policing generally, there's been a great push to be supportive of underrepresented groups, women, ethnic minorities, LGBT. So, look, that's been a big push in the policing, and it is right that the police are representative and reflective, and there's still work to be done. So I think maybe there's a little bit of reluctance, risk aversion, when you're actually taking on sometimes inappropriate behaviour within those groups. You know, as can happen with any organisation and any individuals, some people make mistakes. And if the LGBT network, in my view, have made a mistake, and I think maybe there's a little bit of reluctance, risk aversion to take them on because of being worried about the reaction publicly and internally. That would be my guess, knowing the culture of the PSNI, but clearly they need to deal with this. And, you know, it's very simple to me. Networks, and there are loads of them, Christian Police Association, Ethnic Minority Police Association, Women's Police Association, if they want to have wee events for their members, that's fine. If they want to have a senior officer come and say, here's some experience that I've got from getting through promotion processes, that's fine. But you cannot limit these things when you're sending out messages based on
And do these emails get fired about between themselves willy-nilly?
No, look, in a big organisation like the PSNI, that's you know, a very serious, important organisation, you can only send emails to the whole organisation if you have an inspector rank or the equivalent police staff grade, and that's actually controlled by an access level in the police IT system. So, and it's for this very reason that you end up with a sort of an argument like this playing out in front of everyone. So no, you have to be an inspector to send emails.
So we've asked the PSNI about this, access to group-wide emails. And they've responded by saying, when officers and staff join the LGBT network, you're not given privileged access to the PSNI email system. Permissions are reviewed on an annual basis. that does not answer the question as to whether the PSNI is comfortable with an officer or this network sending this out organization-wide with a statement that straight people are excluded from that network's training.
No, and that tends to be the very reason why, if you want to send a message internally to the whole organisation, you either have to be an inspector or you send it to an inspector, because it's someone with a degree of seniority. They look at it, they say, is this okay to go out, and they send it. That filter process. I don't know why that's not being applied. But, you know, I think Jim makes a point. The fact that this is, the PSNI have got themselves inextricably linked to this LGBT network because this is being done on their networks. It's been done with their equipment. It's been done with their time, their members. And they need to make clear whether this represents their values or not. And, you know, I think they just need to stamp it. If the Christian Police Association, of which there is, put an email out saying, look, we're throwing out open coaching for people, come along. You don't need to be a member of our network, but see, as you approach the door, you've got to tell us you're a practicing Christian. That would be outrageous and cause outrage. And these are the problems that...
Well, let's just flip it to explain the story if anybody isn't getting it. Can you imagine the PSNI being ambivalent to a message being sent out around their organisation if that memo said, look, you don't need to be part of any straight group to avail of the training, but you better assure us that you're straight or you will not be allowed into these training classes. It's the same thing. This LGBT network is saying, you've got to assure us you're gay or you are not welcome into this training. And the management team are not saying that's intolerable within the PSNI. So flip it. If straight officers suddenly said, no gay people welcome in our classes, how would that go down?
Well, you've now got a Catholic Police Guild in the organisation, which again is a good thing. It shows externally and internally there's support for Catholic officers underrepresented. But again, if they said that, no prods allowed, no Muslims allowed. I mean, this is the Pandora's box that's been opened because this hasn't been properly thought through. And, you know, what sort of organisation is it? You want to have people who have to give a wink or a nod to identify themselves as one way or other before they go into a room to get coaching? I mean, you know, I'm frustrated because I love the PSNI and I know this doesn't represent its real values, but someone needs to get a grip of this.
William's in Portadown. Morning, William.
Stephen, it's just a very quick observation. If you cast your mind back to Belfast Pride, the PSNI made very explicit to their officers that they were not to take part in uniform in Belfast Pride. And I think it's a bit of a coincidence that this has now come out, that this LGBT organisation doesn't want straight officers in. Just another point as well.
They don't want straight officers in their training. They're happy to have straight officers in their group as allies, but they don't want them in this training to get promoted. Question, why not?
Well, I think this could be, as I say, it's a coincidence, and it could be a dig back at the PSNI hierarchy that banned all officers taking part in the Belfast Pride. And I think it's a very, very clear dig to set them apart from actual
It's my understanding that the senior team within the PSNI had nothing to do with this memo.
No, I'm not saying it is, but what I'm saying is the LGBT organisation that is having a dig at the senior group, saying, right, you're saying that the officers aren't allowed to take that part in Belfast Pride. We're not going to allow straight officers then to take part in our little group here, but you're not allowing them to take part in Pride. And another just a quick point, Stephen. I think this LGBT organisation has missed a trick here, because they could promote themselves if they put it out to all officers, regardless of gay, straight, or whatever. They could use that to bring them into the organisation and to maybe promote their cause within straight officers, if it was available to every officer come along. We'll take you through. We'll give you a few hints and tips and help you with your advancement in the force. And then just while we're here, can we just promote this here about our organisation as well?
John Burroughs, I wonder how representative the senior ranks are within the PSNI in terms of sexuality.
I actually think it's quite a positive story, to be honest. I mean I know a lot of, for example, people of chief inspector superintendent rank, chief superintendent rank, and in the last number of years there's been quite a strong representation of people who would be LGBT. And of course, I don't know everyone's sexuality or sexuality, but those who were open about it, it was quite a strong representation. I certainly don't know if any data has been done around underrepresentation. And if it was, then there would be ways of trying to deal with that in terms of, you know, encouraging people, looking at the obstacles to promotion, and dealing with that in a fair and objective way, not this, I think, inappropriate way. But in my sort of very anecdotal sense, I don't think that's been I don't think it's vastly underrepresented.
Okay, John, thank you. Jason, morning, Jason.
Well, good morning, Stephen. I have a big guess. If this is true,
what do you mean? If it's true, we don't broadcast stuff that isn't true.
Well, if it is, then this is discrimination against people just because of what they are. People are being specially trained because they're saying what sexuality they are, and that should not be right. The best person should get the job, but it's not going to happen if this...
Well, that's not true. This is not the board process. This is a network within the PSNI trying to prepare people to get a job. A board is an interview process. Religion, sexuality, says this straight officer, or politics, should not matter in the organisation, let alone a promotion process. Look, we'll pause there. 03030 80 55 55. Let's get the news now from the BBC. The Stephen Nolan Show. Now, just a warning, there may be offensive language, language you find offensive in this next item. Another day, another incident of racism in Northern Ireland as a road sign has appeared reading "No illegal immigrants for 1 mile" in Moygashel, just outside Dungannon. It has since been removed. The police have confirmed that they're treating it as a racially motivated hate incident. Then in Londonderry, graffiti has appeared on 4 new build homes saying "No tags, no scum, no migrants, and enter at your own risk." Darren Strabane, Deputy Mayor, Ulster Unionist Party's Darren Guy is with us this morning. Good morning, Darren.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, and Malachy Quinn, SLP Councillor for Mid Ulster. Good morning, Malachy. Good morning. Well, Darren, it's how you stop this. All like-minded people are going to condemn it. How do we stop it, Darren?
This is the big question, Stephen. You know, when we look at our own assembly, and we're so many years on from the Good Friday Agreement, and basically we haven't even dealt with sectarianism, never mind racism, now creeping under that equation.
So the riots, have stopped, but it seems to be the incidents are frequent. The racist incidents in Northern Ireland, aren't they?
They're definitely on the increase. You know, when we were lucky enough here in the Northwest to stay away from the actual protests. There had been one planned for the area about 2 weeks ago, and no one knew who was behind it. Everybody was basically warning people to stay away from it. That was, we worked with right across the community, everybody from the community. They basically say, we don't want this here in the city. And even, you know, whenever there was a counter protest talked about, we were able to sort of quell that as well, just in case it had got out of hand. But it was rejected then, and it's still being rejected. You know, we know people do have concerns about, you know, asylum seekers and so on like that there. And probably the government needs to be more transparent in basically giving people facts and figures. But the people who are bearing the brunt of this racism, as we've seen in Belfast, as people who are working in the health service, people who have came here to set up their own businesses and pay their taxes. And it's no different right across Northern Ireland. These people are here to work. They provide a great service within the health service and so on. And, you know, people should actually think the next time they have to attend casualty, with whether it be themselves, their kids, their mother or father, you know, basically the person, the doctor from Kenya, the nurse from Zimbabwe, or basically the nurse from the Philippines, they're all here to work and help people and provide a service. And they are the people that are keeping the NHS here up and running. And they should be respected in all walks of life because they're given to society.
Maliki?
Yeah, I can't really disagree with anything that was said there, to be perfectly honest. I live in Killeen, working Dungannon. The amount of foreign nationals that have come in, they've taken up their jobs, working really hard every day. They're contributing to the community, not just through work, but through community groups, through local sports teams and everything, through local schools. The contribution that they give to society is immense. And unfortunately, we just have some narrow-minded people.
So where is this coming from then? You look at the Belfast Telegraph today, they give out this statistic, article written by Garrett Horgan. Northern Ireland experienced 1,411 race-related incidents in the 12 months from July 23 to June 24, the highest on record.
Yeah, and that's shocking. And unfortunately, the sign that was in McGastle yesterday is just the one in a long line of incidents over the last couple of years that we have seen in the local community. To me, it's always been about education, Stephen, and it's educating people just on. You talk about sectarian at the start of the conversation here. It's the same thing. Nobody is born sectarian. Nobody is born racist. These things are talked about in the homes. They're talked about in the community, and they are ignorant comments that are made to people, and people take them on board and take them to extreme.
Did you see the sign, Maliki?
Say it again, sorry?
Did you see the sign?
Yes, I seen the sign, yes.
Was the totality of what it said, no illegal immigrants for 1 mile, is that all it said?
That's all that I've seen anyway, Stephen, on it. And the picture of a dinghy at the side. And it was absolutely disgusting. The amount of people that live locally, that have come from different countries, as was already said, the contribution that they make to even the local engineering companies here in Dungannon, the local health service, they keep these places afloat with the work that they're doing. And for anybody to put up a sign like that, for anybody to tell somebody they're not welcome in the community, they're not welcome in the house, is absolutely disgusting.
And when I said there, is that all it said? I wasn't meaning to diminish the vulgarity, the offence that caused. There's some of our callers suggesting that there were other statements on it about religion and things, but you didn't see that, Maliki?
No, I never seen that. And I do know there has been a litany of incidents over the last couple of months and years with signs going up saying no immigrants need to apply for housing. I know there's been local landlords that have been intimidated, told not to rent to foreign nationals.
We're talking, the education minister is going to be in the news cycle today talking about these mobile phones. I just wonder, is the answer to this education at a really early age so that we at least ensure that the next generation living in Northern Ireland understands what racism is and understands how abhorrent it is?
I would agree with that.
Parents need educated as well, don't they?
No, I think there's a lot of people need educated in this, Stephen. It's not just coming from young people now. There's a lot of middle-aged and older people that are coming out and making these statements. But I believe education is vital in teaching people. Now, we've a lot of foreign nationals coming over and going into our schools, and they're being educated alongside everybody. And that's vitally important and gives people the right message. But no, I think specifically in the case of racism and sectarianism, there does need to be a programme run through our schools.
Maliki, Darren, thank you very much indeed. Next on Nolan, the weight loss jab, Ozempic, has been hailed as the fountain of youth. This was on the front page of the Daily Telegraph, the Times, the Daily Express at the weekend. It's a weight loss injection. Don't take any injection, anything, without speaking to your doctor first. But this is being touted as being able to not just help you lose weight, but slow down the biological ageing process. Could that be true? Well, there are a range of opinions on it. One of them is from Dr. Jeremy Samuel Faust from the Harvard Medical School. I began by asking Jeremy what had been learned about these drugs and what they can achieve.
Well, what we learned last year was that for people with heart disease, that these drugs can actually decrease mortality from all causes, cardiovascular disease. And then the surprise was that even there were fewer deaths in patients who received these drugs from other causes, non-cardiovascular diseases. And that led investigators to look into whether some of these deaths had been COVID deaths. And it turned out that patients who'd been on semaglutide for a couple of years when the COVID pandemic started, actually, when they went on to get COVID-19, died about a third less of the time than the people who'd been on placebo during that time.
What is a semaglutide?
Well, semaglutide is the actual active compound in these drugs. And that's just the scientific sort of, that's the generic name for the compound itself. And the compound itself is called the glucagon-like receptor agonist, meaning glucagon is a hormone we have in our bodies, and semaglutide is basically a synthetic version of a similar molecule that our body recognizes as essentially an appetite suppressant.
So that's what it does? Does it go to the brain and suppress appetite, or what does it do?
Well, there are these GLP-1s, the glucagon-like receptor peptides. There are receptors for these molecules all over the body, and they're in the GI, the gastrointestinal tract. They're in the brain as well. But I think that we don't exactly know where and how these molecules are interacting, but we do know that it has some pretty important clinical effects. Among one, you know, the big one, I think, is appetite suppression. It slows down the rate of the stomach kind of pushing things forward into the small intestine and forward. And that just makes people want to eat less. And when they eat less, their metabolic demands really change. And over time, that has tremendous health benefits.
Their metabolic demands, is that fancy talk for hunger?
Well, metabolic demand, well, no, not exactly. Hunger is what drives us just to eat. And if we eat too much, our body has to process that. And so our metabolic rate changes to process all the calories coming into our body. And so over time, if we overeat, the metabolic demand, meaning the activities of our body to process that energy into fat tissue or into energy, that goes up over time. But in exchange for that, if we overeat, that leads to buildup of all kinds of inflammation, which can cause heart disease, can cause kidney disease, can cause diabetes. And so these drugs do the opposite. They say, look, we're full. We don't need more. We need less. And so therefore, over time, how much energy we are burning, how much we're taking in goes down. And as a result of that, these inflammatory pathways that can cause all these various diseases seems to reduced dramatically.
There are risks with most drugs. What are the side effects? Every time I go to America and you see an ad for any medication, they take about 10 minutes telling you how you're going to die in multiple different ways from how you might die or get serious disease. Like it's unbelievable. What are the side effects possibly of these drugs?
Yeah, so we have a strange system here in the United States where these drug companies are permitted to directly market them, their products to consumers. But in exchange for that, they've got to list off, you know, all of these umpteen things that could happen to them, whether or not they're common or rare. In this case, first of all, I'll say, as you say, with any drug, there are benefits and there are possible side effects, and we always want to balance those. And with these compounds, I will say I'm unusually encouraged because we keep seeing that the benefits are incredibly important ones. Decreased heart attacks, decreased mortality, now even COVID mortality reduced. These are incredible benefits. Now, as you say, nothing comes without a risk. We have from these trials, and we have also from observational data afterwards, that there are the most common side effect is nausea, gastrointestinal kind of discomfort, mostly during the early phases. So people can get inflammation of the pancreas. This is not pancreatic cancer. It's just a pancreatitis, inflammation. That seems to have been a little higher in people who took this drug. Although I will say in this big trial, there was no difference between placebo and semaglutide, same rates of that condition. And sometimes people will have other conditions, like their intestines kind of temporarily stop pushing things through. That's called an obstruction, or the medical term would be an ileus. But again, these are self-limited. We haven't seen any major side effects that that would really be much cause for alarm, when on the other side of the ledger is a decrease in heart attacks, is a decrease in mortality.
Although, have they been around long enough for us to be confident, or do we not know yet in terms of the dangers? Look, it's highly tempting. You know, I'm not asking for a friend. I'm asking for me. I'm 19 stone. I can't lose weight. It sounds too good to be true, Dr. Faust.
Yeah.
So, do we know enough about these drugs to be sure?
Well, first of all, I will say, as a clinician, I work in emergency departments, and I very frequently started to notice about a couple of years ago that we'd see these patients, we'd see their vital signs, we'd see their weight, and I would say, that patient does not weigh what they say they weigh. They weigh a lot less. And then I would look, and lo and behold, they'd be on one of these drugs. It really has been amazing. And we're seeing lower rates of heart attacks. I think that, as you say, with any drug, we want to see long-term follow-up. What we have so far is quite a bit more than usual for a quote-unquote blockbuster, because these drugs have been around in earlier generations for diabetes. So we've been seeing for over a decade now, these patients do quite well. Now, who's to say that 30 years from now, something might not crop up? I mean, that's definitely something we're going to watch. But what's so unusual here is that right now the benefit is not some decrease in something like your cholesterol level, and who knows what that means, or your blood pressure level, which, you know, you'd like it to be lower, but who knows what that adds to your daily risk. The benefits we're seeing in certain patients is life or death. They don't die as much. And so if 30 years from now it turns out that there's some increase in something that we don't like, we don't want to hear about, that'll have a very steep climb to overcome all the benefits today. So I'm unusually optimistic, but that doesn't mean that something's not going to crop up. And the caveat, of course, is that if there are patients who wouldn't benefit from this in the same way, they won't have that mortality benefit because they're already fairly healthy. What you're doing is you're putting those people at risk, because, as you say, who's to say 20 years from now what will happen to people who take it? And if their lives weren't saved, what did they get? So that's a very important thing that we're watching.
This then, if it turns out to be as much of a wonder drug as some people are suggesting, this puts health systems around sophisticated societies under intense pressure, because there are lots of fat people, there are lots of obese people, and they will want this on the public health services. How do you think the NHS in the UK, your health service, how will these be afforded?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important question. And for every single kind of patient population, these systems think in terms of something called willingness to pay. And a very simple example of this would be, if I told you that there's a cure for a certain kind of cancer, but it would cost £1 trillion per dose, you know, we can't afford to do that, right? No matter how great of a treatment it is. So there are certainly already populations that have been studied for this compound that, or these compounds, where the usual economic analysis, in my view, has been met, meaning it's worth it. There's some argument as to where that line is, right? If it's just for obesity, maybe not. But if it's for obesity and, you know, history of a stroke or heart attack, then yes. And so the question is really going to be, for whom is it cost effective, and can we afford it at what point? And I think that, you know, obviously a few things can help with that. One is for the price to come down, which I think will happen inevitably. Two is for us to continue to understand the benefits. So if we understand that these are life-saving for 50-year-old people, well, that adds economic benefits. We might someday find out that these drugs lead to fewer knee replacements, which would be cost-saving. So you have to take these things into account. And I think the sort of second and third-order effects are things that we're going to be studying. But yeah, I think there are some patients for whom it's cost-effective already, and there are probably some for whom, you know, it wouldn't be economically wise just to help them lose a few extra pounds.
There are reports that... Well, I'll read from this newspaper. The mind-blowing results showed the drugs appear to slow down standard markers for aging in a way no other medication has achieved. Is that true?
Well, it depends on what you mean by aging. I mean, I hear terms like fountain of youth, and I think people imagine like waking up one day and looking like they're about ready to go to university again. And I think what they mean by that is that you might be someone who is 50, 60, 70 years old, and suddenly you have the risks of someone 10 years younger than that age, or that if you go back to having risks you had when you were 30, when you're 40. I think that's what is how I would think about this quote unquote sort of fountain of youth or markers of aging. But yes, I mean, look, people's cholesterol goes up as they age. There's a diabetes diagnostic blood test called hemoglobin A1C that rises with age and is how we diagnose diabetes. These drugs have been absolutely incredible in lowering those numbers where other drugs have quite frankly failed. And it's just that is why I'm like I say, like I mentioned, unusually optimistic about this, because it's not like we haven't tried other things. And I had to see it to believe it. I mean, again, when I look at these studies, I look at the methods, I look at the data, and these drugs just continue to surprise me.
So you're seeing this in hospitals, in real patients, the real results from this, are you?
Well, look, it's hard for me to say who would and would not have had a heart attack, right? But when I see a patient who it says that they, you know, they weigh 140 kilos and I walk in and they don't look anything like that, I have to imagine that the downstream impact of that is pretty impressive. And these studies show that, right? These studies show that when people lose 10, 20% of their body weight, along with it comes these reductions in these major cardiac events like heart attacks. So yeah, I ask patients, how do you feel? And they just say they feel great. I mean, look, there are some who have side effects, and I have seen patients, by the way, who while they were just starting taking the drug had those side effects and said, I'm not sure this drug is for me, or I have to change the dose. And they talk about it with their doctors, or refer them back to their GPs, their general practitioners. But yes, I have really been amazed by I've been noticing this, seeing how they feel, and noting what a difference these drugs are making for people. And again, if it can be afforded,
how much is it?
Well, in the United States, it depends. I think it's over $10,000 a year in the United States right now. But that's not what patients are paying out of pocket, of course. So, and then there's also, of course, there's different formulations, and there's going to be government intervention in terms of, you know, lowering the price. So, but yeah, I mean, it's at the moment it's quite expensive.
And if someone is on it, does it help? When you're talking about it's making people feel full, as soon as they stop taking it, do they feel like they need to overeat again, or does this retrain the body over time, retrain the mind?
So I think it's a little bit of both, and that's an area where I think the research is beginning to look into. Like, for example, these studies go out 3-4 years, which is pretty good, but how do they do 5-6 years later, and who among them stops? I've seen data that says maybe that I think once people stop taking these drugs, they do start to, not overnight, but they start to sort of, their body eventually might sort of pendulum back a bit. But about 1/3 of patients don't. So those people might just get off the drugs and maybe they'll be able to stay off of them forever. We don't know that. But there's at least a reasonably sized group who that's very optimistic. Then people do gain back some of the weight, and with it, their markers of that we mentioned could actually get worse again. The question is, over what period of time and to what extent? And the analogy I would use is, if you sort of start on the top of a ladder, and you're on the 10th rung, and it brings you down to the 3rd rung, and you stop taking them, and then over a year or two, you're up you're on the 4th or 5th or 6th rung. Well, maybe after a couple of years of that, it's time to maybe go back on it and get down to the 3rd rung again. And so I think that this is an area that's wide open. There is a dogma in the field that says, oh, people should be on these things forever. And I think that that's really untested. I think that's something that, yes, we know that some people might have to be on them for long term or might have to resume them.
Do children take it?
I think that children have maybe this is not an area where I'm familiar. I'm not a pediatrician. I think there are some children, teenagers, who've been given it, but those studies that I've been reading are adult studies. So I wouldn't get ahead on the same benefits, because again, I'm sure there are some who've been on it, but you know, for a morbidly obese teenager, the risks of having a fatal heart attack at the age of 20 is very low. It's really when they go on to be older when those risks crop up. So it's a different conversation.
And is there an age at which the risk sharply increases? Like, does that happen in obviously it can happen at any time, but is there any graph to show, does it happen on average in your 30s, your 40s, your 50s, your 60s? What's the age at which you start to run out of chance?
Well, I think it really depends on the person. The studies that have been, these big blockbuster studies, have been very often middle-aged and sort of early geriatric, sort of, you know, people in their 40s and 50s, you know, and then some in their 60s and 70s. And that's where the studies have been done, just because, quite frankly, in order to do a good study, you have to have enough bad events to prevent, right? If the risk of a heart attack, even in a very, very high risk 30-year-old, might be 1 in 1,000, it's going to be very hard to reduce that in a study. You'd need, you know, 1 million patients. Whereas in a 60-year-old with a history of high cholesterol and diabetes and high blood pressure, maybe that, you know, 1 in 100 of those people might have a heart attack in a year. And so it's easier to study the effect in it with that rate.
Let me double back to one of the basics, just a few more questions, and thank you, sure, Jeremy, for your time. You mentioned in this interview a number of times about how obesity causes inflammation, and I don't actually understand inflammation in the body. I think I know what that means, but is inflammation inside the body? What do you mean by that? What's happening if we're obese?
Yeah, that's sort of a catch-all term, and it's a term that I understand is sort of understood to be vague, and that's actually kind of intentional. And the reason for that is that obesity and related syndromes, things that come from obesity, have so many prongs of potential risk associated with them that it's really impossible to say that to draw a line like A to B to C, and this is how it works. It's really for every organ system, it's a little bit different. And for every person, it's a little bit different. But, you know, a really good example might be that if you weigh more than is healthy, your heart actually ends up having to really work harder, actually literally work harder. And it's sort of being stressed at every beat to push that blood to all the tissues of your body. And as a result of that, the arteries harden up. And so that's done, that's through an inflammatory pathway where there's literally a buildup of plaque and of damage to the vessels. And eventually that damage can lead to heart attacks. So that's just one example of how being in this sort of hyper caloric state, you know, constantly more calories than the body really needs, can really damage the body. And so the term inflammation, it sort of is a catch-all for a number of these pathways that over time confer a ton of risk.
Have you ever been as excited? Like, you sound, and look, I'm not trying to be offensive, but if I can just say this bluntly, I'm minded to ask you, do you have any type of interest, financial or otherwise, in this drug, or is this the most exciting drug you've come across in your career? You sound so effusive about it. I keep on thinking that like it couldn't be this good.
Yeah. So I take absolutely zero money from any pharmaceutical company. That is just a badge that I've chosen for myself. And it's really precisely so that in the very rare circumstance where something truly miraculous appears to be happening, that I can speak to these questions without that kind of conflict. And I think that, look, there are people who are experts who take money from these companies, and that doesn't necessarily negate their opinion, but I think it's impossible to know how much it influences their opinion. And so
is this the most exciting drug you've come across?
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm you know, whatever. I've been a physician since for a decade plus. I wasn't around when the retroviral combination therapy for HIV came on. You know, I mean, that would have been another like amazing moment in the 1990s where AIDS and HIV went from a sure death sentence to a manageable disease. That would have been a bigger moment probably because that was a certain death sentence for so many. But like, that's kind of like, I think about it, like, when was the last time we had something this big? And I feel like that's one where we think about, look, I was pretty impressed with the COVID vaccines. These were miracles in their own way. But it's, most of the time when these pharmaceutical companies come out with some treatment and it makes a headline, maybe an Alzheimer's drug has been a really good example recently, and there have even been some other heart disease drugs in the past, it's been a lot of hype. And I think that I always find myself sort of squinting at the studies and finding things to complain about. And the reason that you're sensing my exuberance here is that I'm not seeing a lot of that. I'm seeing really just encouraging news just constantly. So yeah, I am unusually optimistic here.
Thank you so much for your time, Jeremy. Thanks for talking to us. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate the interest. Thanks so much.
So the Education Minister, Paul Given, is set to tell schools to bring in new rules to restrict pupils from using mobile phones. The guidance is also expected to say mobile phone bans might help to reduce student distraction in the classroom. The DUP MLA, Peter Martin, has been at the centre of the discussions of this with the Education Minister. Good morning to you, Peter.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Thank you for talking to us today. So, look, what are we looking at here? Total ban for primary school kids and guidance for secondary, or what are we looking at?
Well, it's my understanding, Stephen, that the Minister is going to announce this morning, so I don't want to preempt anything that he says, but obviously Robbie has been reporting, I think, some elements of it. So I think that's probably a fair summary of what we might see this morning.
So give us your assessment of what is about to be said.
Well, I mean, I think if we make the assumption that there is going to be restrictions on primary school children and some in terms of smartphones, and then further restrictions in terms of post-primary, I mean, I think this is a great idea. This was brought to me by some constituents some time ago, and I wrote to the minister about it. There's really good research, Stephen, and this is an example of policy following what the evidence base actually says, where children are really distracted. There's increasing mental health issues, and there's evidence to say that smartphones and social media play a role in that. And also Policy Exchange have produced some really interesting figures around the fact that certainly in England, schools that have effective restrictions on phones actually outperform schools that don't.
So there's going to be a difference here in, it's going to be a total ban in primary schools, is that right?
Well, I just said, look, I can't preempt what the minister's saying. My understanding is that he's making an announcement this morning, but Robbie was certainly reporting something along those lines.
So I'm just trying to understand this so that our callers can engage in this, right?
Sure.
So if it's a total ban on primary school children, where would the discretion be in your view? Where should it be, Peter, with secondary school kids?
So with secondary school kids, actually, it's a case that secondary school kids are under more pressure in terms of social media. I think the engagement that smartphones allows them to have in schools. So if we're serious about raising educational standards, if we're serious about trying to deal with some of these mental health issues, then actually having access to a smartphone in post-primary just doesn't help that. And all the research is there to support that.
Why not ban it then?
Well, look, I'm not sure what the minister is going to say. My understanding is that the minister will be writing out to all schools this morning with a circular. And just to help your listeners understand what that is, this is not legislation. This is not the minister banning, or the minister saying to all schools, no more smartphones. This is a procedure that the department has whereby it will instruct boards of governors to issue certain new policies that adhere to what the circular says. So if we take the assumption that actually in primary schools, no more smartphones, the minister will issue a circular and it'll be up to boards of governors to adopt that and say, look, in primary schools, we don't want any more smartphones for these reasons.
What about secondary schools?
Secondary schools, again, it'll depend on what the minister is actually going to say in terms of secondary schools. Certainly, my understanding is that I think for the vast majority of cases, access to phones in secondary schools or post primaries is also problematic, because you do have that added distraction of their phone going off. A lot of schools already have this. I know in place, Michael Allen is in Liz Neal has it in place and is seeing really good results from it. So this is just, I just think it's a really effective way of trying to address two things at once. One is the mental health crisis that we have with many children, you know, at the level we're talking about. And the second one is just educational standards and the fact that evidence suggests that they rise when you ban these things.
Peter, when you start getting up the years in secondary school, so, yeah. You know, once you're starting to be in, I don't know, and you could, of course, go below this, but let's, for the sake of our conversation, you're talking about fifth year, sixth year.
Sure.
Young people. In other words, they're 16, they're 17, they're 18.
Yeah.
So some of those young people are going to say there is a rank hypocrisy here from adults banning them from having mobile phones in school. And yet adults who are in the workplace to work sit on their mobile phones half the day. So why, for example, would it be okay for MLAs to bring their mobile phones into Stormont when you're all supposed to be concentrating on the debates? Will you lead by example? Will the DUP not bring in mobile phones to their place of work in at least Stormont?
My wife would agree with you. She'd love to see me putting the mobile phone down, but I suppose it's part of our job and part of our interaction that we need to be contactable at a very basic level. That would
come
be
on
case.
Now but, during a debate.
Oh, no, maybe not during the debate, but in general terms.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to be funny saying this. I'm just trying to represent that all of us as adults, you know, when I'm presenting right now for the BBC, I've got my mobile phone out, I flick through it. When I'm in the office, half the Nolan team, if they're awake, are on their mobile phones. So we all as adults, do this, don't we?
We do.
And yet we're telling these young people they've got to concentrate. There is a rank hypocrisy in all of this.
Well, I think you have a point. However, certainly in our family, you know, we have rules around smartphones, you know, so there's no phones at the table. And sometimes the adults get told off by the kids about having a phone at the table. So I agree. I think if you apply it, Stephen, to what the minister is going to do today, I think there probably does need to be some flexibility around sixth form in particular. But, you know, look, in general terms, kids are at school both to learn and also to be in an environment where they're not under the pressures that they might face whenever they leave school. And smartphones increase those, and the evidence there is just quite clearly there to show that.
And I want to come back to that evidence in a minute. Just to push this one stage further.
Sure.
It is the same argument, isn't it, to say that people in school should be concentrating on their work and people, adults in work, should be concentrating on their work.
Yeah.
It's the same argument.
And
these kids are not stupid. They're smart. And they're going to be watching adults telling them what to do, and the adults aren't doing it themselves.
Well, I think there's a reason that we're looking at these restrictions in schools, because I think at that age, especially these formative age of sort of, you know, 12 to 14 and upwards, there's enough pressure on our kids already. And so having access to a smartphone either in school or possibly just at lunchtime, schools have a whole range of policies here, Stephen, currently. And what the minister, I think, is going to do is he's going to try and uniform those. So what we don't have is one school sort of saying, well, we're going to have this level of ban, and another school is going to say we're having this level of ban, or whatever it is, these restrictions, actually have some uniformity across the sector. And certainly principals that I've spoken to want that uniformity, so they will not be the only school doing X or the only school doing Y. And simply for, I think, for teachers as well, again, having that uniformity across the system where teachers don't have to, you know, keep policing this, which is what they are doing at the moment. It adds workload to them. It adds stress to them, telling people to turn that off, give that to me. If the phones are effectively not in school, especially at a primary level, that solves a problem. And just to, I mean, if I give you one example, Stephen,
help me with the research. So let's get into the research now. What does the data suggest?
Okay, so there's a really good piece by Jonathan Haidt and a book by him. Now, I can't claim to have read it, but I have read some of the summary around it. And Politics Jane then did a big piece in terms of looking at this within the UK. So one of the things that they found was that there is we know that there's a linkage between social media use and declining mental health in our kids because of that active nature of it, that they're always contactable. So that is one thing that I think we can address. The second thing is a really interesting one, because obviously my background is in education. And so part of the research says that actually schools, and this is in England, schools that had an effective ban were more than twice as likely to be rated outstanding than the national average. That kids there achieve better results at GCSE. And this was, in fact, despite the fact that schools with a ban had a higher proportion of FSME. So schools that you might have thought might have been underperforming, when they introduced really effective restrictions on smartphones, they actually outperform some schools that we might assume would actually should be better.
Now, that's really interesting, I wonder if you're extrapolating too much, though, because, of course, there is the possibility that for those schools who are strict enough or mindful enough to apply that ban, that they're also strict enough or mindful in terms of their teaching practices, their extracurriculum revision courses. Yep. I don't know. You'd need to understand that before you extrapolate, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you absolutely would. And whenever I read that data, that's what I thought. There could be other softer factors around that. But that's, I mean, certainly the data is sound. I mean, this has been well researched. And it's been done at a high level, but you're actually right. There could be other factors, but it does point in a really sound direction that actually doing this can raise educational standards. And I am completely convinced that doing this will help kids in a school environment not to be so influenced by social media and the pressure. And we know this just from our society, the pressure that social media interaction, constant interaction, provides for our children. And I might just give you this one example. I mean, we've been pretty good with our kids, but I now have a son in P7. I've got a daughter in big school and a younger son. My middle son, he has a phone. And I mean, one night the phone kept dinging. And I thought, is that for me? And he got 73 WhatsApp messages in an evening. Now, he wasn't even looking at it. You know, he was away doing something else. But whenever I went, I thought it was my phone. 73 WhatsApp messages in one evening just from class groups. And I just think if we can do something to address these problems, I think it'll be really, really positive for our kids and for our society in general.
Just finally, is it a problem if your son's got so many friends and people are interacting? We're demonising here conversation. One of the modern ways of conversation is on a phone, is what on a WhatsApp message, on a text message. Is it not a lot better? Let's not talk about your son. Is it not a lot better that any young person is rather than sitting in a darkened room, is chatting to all of their friends at night? We need to again be careful that we're not demonizing something that's part of this modern world, again, that adults do. And lots of those WhatsApp messages will be good, funny, informative conversation between friends. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, so that's possible. But what we're also doing is we're teaching our children a way of interacting that's not how we interacted as we grew up.
Welcome to the modern world.
Absolutely. But you know yourself that whenever you're dealing with the Nolan team, you have to be able to interact, you know, professionally with them in an effective way. If kids are learning that the only way to interact is over WhatsApp, that will not serve them well whenever they hit the real world, because we all have to interact with each other and socialize with each other in a way that's kind of acceptable and positive. And actually, if the only way you know how to interact is with a WhatsApp message, that's doing a disservice to our children.
Flip that, Peter. Right? Absolutely. So our age, our generation, you know, we talk to each other, but maybe older people you know, yourself, myself, I don't even know what age you are. Are you young or how old are you?
I'm 53.
Right, well, you're definitely old. So, you're 2 years older than me.
Well,
right?
You're a youngster, though.
Right, but here's the crack. You know, conversing in a modern way on WhatsApp, on Twitter, not being afraid of it, understanding. You know, some of the biggest business marketplaces now are on Facebook, are on eBay, are on computers.
Yep.
We need to be careful that there's not an older generation here on imposing old-fashioned communication norms on a young populace.
I agree completely, and that's why we're not saying, and certainly I wouldn't be saying, you know, our kids should not at all be, for example, using WhatsApp to organize a play date, for example, at the weekend. That's for parents. I mean, it's for parents to look after, and that's a parental responsibility. So we're not saying, in terms of technology, you know, it's all bad, don't do it. But what we are saying that in a school environment, there should be different standards, and it should be a safe place where kids are not, you know, having to deal with the pressures of social media all the time. So I'm not saying, you know, technology is bad or anything. Technology is wonderful, and you're completely right. It's an effective tool and medium that kids have to learn and be able to use, but they have to do that in the right context, and they have to do that in the right environment.
I'm just looking here at how many times the minister, Paul Given, has WhatsApped me or messaged me. Well, that's for another day.
Oh, break that story, Stephen. That'd be a good one.
Thank you, Peter. Good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Stephen. Morning to you. Steve's in Armagh. Morning, Steve.
Hi, Stephen. How's things?
What do you think?
Yeah, broadly, it's a good idea. But there's one oversight, and that's children with type 1 diabetes. The technology has moved so far forward in the treatment that their smartphones have now become medical devices where they can monitor their bloods through their sensors
can
and
they?
Different things.
That's interesting.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. And I've even had my son, who's type 1, being at school and teachers trying to take a phone off him when he was actually just monitoring his bloods.
That's interesting.
So that's where you run into a bit of trouble.
Somebody's reminding me here that he's not an independent MP, Alex Easton. Well, wasn't he shopping for shoes during a Stormont debate?
I don't know.
He was. Thank you, Steve. Emma Wolfe, commentator. Kathleen O'Hare, former school principal. Morning, Emma.
Morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Kathleen.
Morning, Stephen.
Well, what do you think, Kathleen?
Well, like Peter, I broadly welcome the advice from the minister, but I have to say it is only stage one. I don't think mobile phones have a place in primary school. They do, however, have a place as a learning device in post-primary school because many A-level students in particular will use their phones for part of their A-levels, maybe in art, maybe in science, maybe in technology. So I think there needs to be a bit of advice on how this is actually done. Grabbing a child's mobile phone at the beginning of a day is not something schools would want to do because that would mean a large post-primary school bringing in up to £1 million worth of technology and storing it all day and then giving it out in the day.
Well, they'll just ban them from bringing them to school, won't they?
Oh, yeah, listen, how do you do that? How do you do that when a parent says, listen, I need to contact them in the evening, I need to do whatever? It is a safety device for lots of children, particularly those children who live maybe 10, 20 miles from school. And, you know, parents rightly will want to be able to contact their children in the evening. So I think banning bringing a post-primary, bringing a phone to school would not be a good idea. But there is an idea, Stephen, and that is one I haven't heard today. And there are systems which means you can block a mobile signal device in a school. And I know other countries have explored this because there's a lot of research, particularly on the adverse effect of like TikTok and Instagram and Reels on children's concentration, but a lot of schools in other countries have explored mobile kids, blocking devices.
Kids are also obviously smart, a lot more adept than some of us sometimes. So I wonder if Paul Given, you know, when he issues this advice today, and he's banning mobile phone devices from primary schools or restricting them, advice to restrict them in secondary schools. I wonder if a kid then says, all right, teacher, Mrs. Whoever, Mr. Whoever, I don't have a mobile phone, but I've got my Apple Watch or I've got my Samsung Watch, whatever brand it is, and on that watch you can look up text messages, you can look up social media. So are they going to ban watches as well?
Well, the minister will already know that this advice has to be given out by the examination board, CIA, every year on the use of mobile watches. So, you know, internet connectivity is across a whole number of devices in a school. So you would have to put that ban in place. And the better connectivity in Northern Ireland than there's any other part of the UK. So there's everybody can get Wi-Fi, but you have to bring in a blocking device to stop that.
What do you think, Emma?
Well, look, I am one of the campaigners for a tech-free childhood. As you know, Stephen, I have a, nearly four-year-old now, who starts school in a couple of days. And I have long said that we're all addicted to mobile phones, and actually children and young people growing up with this, you know, there's almost nothing really positive about the internet for them, I don't think. I think it's full of bullying and violence and porn and...
Oh, it's a place to learn, isn't it? It's a place where you don't... it's a lot... The internet's a lot better than that, Emma, isn't it?
It is now. It is full of good stuff, but there is so much that outweighs that. I'm bringing up my son with books without television. I know, look, I'm a rank hypocrite. You use the term rank hypocrisy. I'm a rank hypocrite because A, I use the phone all the time for work. B, I'm on telly and radio most days, so I get it. But in terms of think about our childhoods, playing outdoors, reading books, interacting with other people, there is a reason why, and I know I am going to argue the other side. I think it's going to be really hard for schools to bring this in. But I just want to say, I think there's a reason why we have a generation of anxious, depressed, antisocial young people who are unable to turn up for job interviews, who are unable to interact with others.
It's such a negative viewpoint on the internet, though. When a child can look up if they want... You take a secondary school child that's interested in the news...
Yeah, they look it up on Google. They look up something on Google.
They can search that.
You know what I would have done? I would have had to go to the library with my brothers and sisters. I would have had to go to the library with my friends and look it up in an encyclopedia. That's what's really sad.
Current affairs, breaking news. Young teenagers can access around the world now.
It's all spoon-fed to you. Boom, 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 in front of you on a screen. And then you flick to one thing and you flick to another and you flick to another and you flick to another.
Kathleen.
You know what it's like. The attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Are you kidding me?
Kathleen,
how much diagnoses have soared?
I don't think we can turn the clock back on technology, and I don't think if we want a modern society, we can. But I think if we're bringing in a policy like this in a school, then the young people need to be involved in that policy because they will know so much more about the internet and abuses than actually the adults that are teaching.
I've been bringing up hypocrisy today, Kathleen. Must it be for at least fairness that a teacher can't sit in a classroom where the kids aren't allowed to use mobile phones?
I think that would be fair. And there are times when, you know, people might need mobile phones because of medical appointments. But I think if you're going to bring in a ban, a blocker is the best way to do that because that blocks it out for everybody, including the school principal, and they may be quite happy with that. The other adverse effect, one of my colleagues has actually banned mobile phones in his school in London, and he had to bring in withdrawal classes for students who actually showed real symptoms of the loss of their mobile phone.
You are not serious.
I can understand that actually happening because their mobile phone is just like an extension of the hand.
Withdrawal classes.
For many adults, the same. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
You have to bring in special classes for withdrawal.
Stephen,
they showed examples of real stress and anxiety at losing their mobile phone.
Well, Emma,
may I come in and explain? There's been a lot of neurological research into the addiction, absolute addiction. We know that adults, so you can put your phone down, and you hear it ping or you see it flash, a notification, and it takes about 7 seconds. Even when you think, right, I'm just going to pop my phone down now, I'm just going to get on with this task. It takes, they've done research, it's about 7 or 8 seconds that we last before we go, oh, I wonder what that was, and pick it up. There has been a wealth of research into the addiction of young people. I've seen it firsthand. I've seen teenagers having their phones taken away from them. It gets better. Of course they get used to it in the way that we all do. But the addiction is absolutely real.
Martin's in West Belfast. Morning, Martin.
Stephen, if they take your kids' phones off them and the kids get a bus from the school to go home and the kids miss the bus, who's going to be responsible to get the kids home?
Well, Kathleen, that's why Kathleen is saying, look, it's illogical to suggest you can stop a kid bringing a phone with them because they'll need it for all sorts of reasons, Martin. She's saying block the signal in the schools.
Well, if that's the case, block the signal at the school during hours, but if the school take it off them and the phone's damaged, who's going to be responsible for the phone
to? Yeah. Do you use your phone a lot?
Every day.
Does it distract you?
No. I'm on the phone with you now. I pulled over. I'm sitting on the side of the road.
Are you working?
No, I'm out in the car.
Right, okay. All right, man.
Can I just say something about the brick phone? That's what I think we need to develop. I've just ordered myself a brick phone, which is literally just calls and text messages. You can imagine how I'm dreading it. Absolutely dreading it. But that is another option for the safety element where you're worried about your teenage child coming back on the bus or the train. You need to be able to text them. You need to be able to check that they're on their way or that they're okay or whatever. That is an option. They call it the dumb phone, the brick phone, that kind of thing.
Emma, thank you very much. Kathleen, thank you as well. I'm sure we'll continue this conversation after we hear what the minister is going to say. He's doing that today. Thank you for your company. Don't forget, if you've got a story, nolan@bbc.co.uk, @StephenNolan on Twitter. If you want to stay in touch with me 24 hours a day, we'll see you tomorrow morning. Have a good day, everyone. Bye-bye.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the problems facing Boeing after failures of its Starliner spacecraft have left two astronauts stranded in space. They were supposed to be on the International Space Station for 8 days, but will now be there for at least 8 months. This is the latest in a long line of crises facing the company. So is this one failure too far for Boeing? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.